Welcome. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is the Your Call Media Roundtable. Every Friday, we invite you into conversation with journalists about the news media's coverage of major stories of the week. And this week, there is no question that the biggest story was in Egypt. On Sunday, over 14 million Egyptians took to streets across the country demanding that President Morsi step down. On July 3rd, the Egyptian military forced Morsi out, and Morsi's supporters call what happened a coup. His opponents call it Revolution 2.0. How should journalists be characterizing what's happening? And as Morsi supporters take to the streets today, and we're hearing in initial reports facing deadly force from the military in certain instances, what should journalists be paying close attention to if they want to understand what happens next? Our guest, Adil Iskander, has been paying close attention to coverage of the unfolding situation in Egypt. He is a scholar of Arab studies at Georgetown, whose research focuses on media and communication, and his work has appeared for in Jadalia and Al Jazeera English. Adil, welcome back to Your Call.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you with us. And this week, the diplomatic uproar caused by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden continued to expand. Bolivian President Evo Morales has gone to the UN to protest the diversion of his personal plane when it was suspected that Snowden might be on board with him. European nations continued to express outrage at the extent of surveillance, while Le Monde revealed a major online surveillance program operated by the French government. And here in the U.S., the number of journalists and media organizations lining up to criticize Edward Snowden expanded to the editorial board of The Washington Post, which has published many of Snowden's revelations. While the reverberations of Snowden's story continue, our guest Marcy Wheeler is one of the sharpest analysts of the controversial and potentially illegal NSA surveillance at the heart of this story. Marcy writes about national security and civil liberties for The Guardian, Salon, and The Nation, and for her own site, EmptyWheel.net. Marcy, so great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Really appreciate it. And we also have with us a perspective from Russia, where Snowden is widely reported to be holed up in the international transit zone of the Moscow airport. Fred Weir is the Christian Science Monitor's Moscow correspondent. He has covered Russia and the former Soviet Union for the past 15 years. Fred, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
And we, as always, we welcome your calls and emails about coverage of Egypt, NSA surveillance, or any of the other major stories of the week. And that includes a story that has affected the lives of a lot of people here in Northern California this week, the Bay Area rapid transit strike. Did the media serve you well in its coverage of the dispute between BART and its workers? We welcome you to get involved in the conversation. If you have a question or saw a piece of reporting or analysis you thought was particularly enlightening this week, please feel free to share it. You can call 866-798-TALK or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. I want to start, as we always do, by talking about reporting and journalism that was done well this week, asking each of our panelists to talk about a specific example of some good journalism from the week. Marcy, let's start with you. What did you see reported this week that you thought was reported well?
Well, one of the most interesting pieces of journalism came when some graduate students at Wisconsin, who are summer students in a language program there, asked some difficult questions of NSA recruiters and got to some language that the NSA uses among itself about what they do. It was on a site called The Mob and the Multitude, which it's a very interesting piece.
And tell us a little bit what that specific language was.
Well, these graduate students, one of whom I believe has a background in anthropology, really hammered on our use of the word adversary, saying, you know, why do we collect so much on Germany? That was one of the big stories of the last week. And really hammered on whether these people are adversaries, hammered on whether the NSA, you know, how can we trust the NSA if both Keith Alexander and James Clapper have had to withdraw comments that they made? It's not polite journalism, but I think it's a very interesting, it's sort of like, you know, for those of us who would like to get the NSA on the record on some questions, they try to do that, and I think it's sort of an interesting piece.
So The Mob and the Multitude, we will post a link to that on our website, yourcallradio.org. Thank you, Marcy. Adil Iskander, I'm sure you have been consuming a huge amount of news this week with all that has been happening in Egypt. What did you see that impressed you?
Well, to be perfectly honest with you, it's been really difficult to identify anything that's been done well because it's such a polarizing climate. But I've really been impressed with the not necessarily the coverage, but the analysis that's coming out of some of the online platforms from the on the Middle East. And one of them is a place where I've published, and not, this is not a plug for them, but they've done just a fantastic job. It's called Jadaliya, J-A-D-A-L-I-Y-Y-A. And one of the particular articles that I thoroughly enjoyed is a piece by the editor of that page, the Egypt page, and it's on the Turkish models of democracy and how they've been, or the attempt has been, to graft them to the Middle East and how they're inconsistent with the realities on the ground. So comparing, you know, the democratic process in Egypt versus Turkey, and how, in some cases, this transplantation of democratic models is just not working because of the particularities of each of those societies and political systems. So I thought it was an extremely thoughtful analysis on politics, religion, secularity, and various other issues that really doesn't come through when you're reading sort of the immediate news on current events from the Middle East.
So, Adel, we will post a link to that piece on our website. But just briefly, if you can, tell us a little bit of why that Turkish model, this analyst thinks that it's not working in Egypt.
Well, for the most part, you know, when the revolution in Egypt happened, there was a general understanding that political Islam will play a significant role in public life. Immediately, prognosticators and analysts and policy experts turned to Turkey as sort of a perfect model, if you will, where you've got an Islamist political party in power that doesn't necessarily disrupt the relationship between this society and the military, that maintains a level of secularity in the system so that there's a separation between religious institutions and the state. And all that looked sort of fine and dandy, but as soon as you apply it in a country like Egypt, you realize that there was never really an enshrinement of secularity in the system, and that the political Islamic force, the Muslim Brotherhood in this case, is not akin to or similar to the AK party in Turkey. And so in terms of strategy and the way they represent themselves, it's just a completely different ballgame. And so you don't get the same results. You get sort of a monopolization of power, and you see sort of the principles of social justice and freedom of expression getting trampled, unlike the case in Turkey. So again, the whole system basically backfires, and the article makes the case that, in fact, it's not just the Turkish model that isn't working in Egypt. Perhaps the Turkish model isn't working in Turkey. So it takes it home in an interesting way. And the author is Hisham Salam, who I think is one of the most creative commentators on the Middle East and Egypt specifically these days.
So that's Hisham Salam. He's on the Egypt page at Jadaliya. We will post a link to that. Fred Weir, want to turn to you. What did you see this week that made you go, okay, here's somebody really doing their job in journalism?
Well, okay, I have to agree with you that Egypt is the big story this week. But over the past few weeks, you know, I just feel like tossing this in, I have been immensely impressed with the reporting of Glenn Greenwald and The Guardian in general, and also saddened by the fact that it's a British newspaper that's not only aggressively leaning into a story that's of massive public interest, but it's editorially supporting its reporters. And I just really impressed by that. If they're erring at all, they're erring on the side of public disclosure, and they're doing a job that, unfortunately, right now, there is no major U.S. Media outlet that will step up to do.
So, I mean, of course, I mean, anyone who's paid attention to the Edward Snowden story has heard the name of Glenn Greenwald and benefited from his reporting in these recent weeks. You say you're saddened it's a British newspaper because you're not seeing that same thing on the U.S. side.
Yeah, a generation ago, and I'm of the age to remember the Pentagon Papers, it was an American newspaper, the New York Times, that took that story and ran with it and defended its sources and defended its reporters, and we're not seeing that right now. That's saddening.
We are definitely going to be talking more about that later in the hour. That's Fred Weir. He's the Moscow correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor. Also with us, Marcy Wheeler, who writes for her website, emptywheel.net, about national security and surveillance, and also Adel Iskander, who is a keen observer of the media and coverage of Egypt. Speaking of Egypt, we've got a caller on the line. I want to go straight there, and then, Adel, I want to get you to talk about you know, just, boy, we've so much has happened in less than a week here. We'll definitely want to dig in. So, Ede in Berkeley, welcome to Your Call. What do you have to say about the developments in Egypt this week?
Thank you for taking my call. I'm actually very, very proud of the coverage of the American media, as well as international media, as well as the Egyptian people themselves. That was tremendous. Only it can happen in Egypt, where you have 33 million people going to the street. Imagine, if that's in America, it would be 100 million people going to the street. So what I was totally disgusted by Morsi and the way he run the country for the last 1 year, and not only myself, my family, back, my niece always writes things about how the horrible thing he had been doing. He consolidated all of his friends and awful people, actually people who have done terrorist act, put it in the government, and totally ignored the benefit or the what is good for Egypt. And honestly, for the last 80 years, the Muslim Brotherhood have never had good standing in Egypt. He won for one reason. Only 26% of Egyptians voted, and only 51% of vote went to him. And that is because the choice Egyptians had were terrible, either him or somebody from Mubarak regime. And that's why he got. But he acted so foolish, so foolish. The other point I'd like to make also that Egypt always has been a secular country. Yes, it is majority Muslim, but it's been secular. The last flag for Egypt was crescent and three stars, one for Christianity, a star for Judaism, and one for Islam. So it is the only country that you cannot fool by religious extremists, and it is time to put an end to this kind of, some group of any kind, Muslim Brotherhood or another, will hijack the policy or a whole country. So I would say good riddance.
Thanks so much for the call, Ede. I want to get a response from Adil Iskander. First, I mean, obviously, Ede's given us a lot there to respond to. Did you feel, Adil, in terms of the coverage by the U.S. and international media, that there's something to be proud of in terms of the way that the coverage of what happened in Egypt this week?
Frankly, no. I didn't see too much to be proud of. I feel like the U.S. media got caught up in a semantic conversation as to whether or not this constituted a military coup, which I think, you know, is important as far as the $1.3 billion that's being spent on the military in Egypt. But in the grand scheme of things, as far as, you know, the tens of millions of people or the, you know, at least the millions of people who protested against Morsi on June 30th and beyond, this issue is generally inconsequential. What you call it, as far as, you know, the academic conversation or the policy conversation, is practically negligible. In addition to that, I felt as though the Muslim Brotherhood, which has basically conducted the country in an extremely undemocratic way, despite having been democratically elected in the past year, and really sort of digging their nails into sort of the constitution and the sort of legal structure of the
country. Adil, could you just... I thought that one thing that was missing from a lot of the coverage was real specificity about what the criticisms of Morsi's time in power have been. Could you just talk a little bit about what you see as kind of the most important critiques of the way that he's run the country?
Keep in mind that Egypt was forgotten for the past year. I mean, it's only big surges of protest that bring Egypt back to the headlines. But in the past year, the Muslim Brotherhood have not reached across the aisle. They've consolidated power in a way that's deeply problematic. They've pushed through a constitution that wasn't agreed upon by significant institutions like the church and Al-Azhar, the oldest seat of Islamic learning, that they've marginalized a lot of people in society, that the rhetoric of the government has become so sectarian to the extent that it appears to endorse and support attacks on Shias in Egypt. I mean, we're talking about a downward spiral, not to mention the day-to-day matters, such as sort of a declining, if not sort of a free-falling economy, the lifting of subsidies on basic food stuff, which has angered, you know, Egypt's sort of middle lower class as well, the working class communities. There have been at least 3,000 strikes and protests over the past year of aggravated workers and laborers in almost every sector and industry in the country. So really, the country is falling apart, and the discourse coming out of the Muslim Brotherhood when they were in power was basically a rallying behind religion and identity politics, which doesn't really solve any problems on the ground, but further inflame divisions within society. And this is a country that's not had major divisions in much of the past 5,000 years. This is a unique turning point. So I think the uprising or the protest that happened on June 30th was an attempt to basically turn back time to the moment when Mubarak was toppled and to reset everything. Of course, the supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood would tell you that's not how it goes. Democracy is democracy. If we're voted in, we get the full term and we do whatever we choose with it and then are reevaluated 4 years later.
But on that semantic discussion that you talked about, the U.S. and international media spending a lot of time, and I mean, one important thing about using a term like a coup is it really, you know, it just brings to fore the challenges of a democracy, or what might, you know, some people are claiming it is an action taken to protect democracy by a military. And I mean, I think that, and you talk about the silence, go ahead.
This is not to absolve the military of interfering in politics in much of the last 60 years or the 18 months of the transition, where they've committed one blunder after the next and are an extremely undemocratic institution. But the majority of Egyptians, or a significant proportion of the Egyptian populace, felt that the situation in Egypt has reached such a cataclysmic point that it was necessary for the military not to interfere in policy making, or not to interfere, but to basically reset the system in a way that resembles basically what happened on February 11th, 2011, when Mubarak was removed. I mean, he was removed by a popular uprising, but it took the military to nudge him aside. So, again, you know, the discussion can go on and on and on about whether or not it was a military coup, but at the end of the day, there is a significant fragmentation in Egyptian society that, you know, agreement will have to begin at an experiential level, and that to move forward in a revolutionary upsurge is to bring all parties together, to work together, rather than to have those with significant electoral gain monopolize the political system and alienate a substantial proportion of the population.
That's
so it's all about reconciling rather than dividing. Unfortunately, the action of the military has further entrenched division. But again, prior to that, it looked as though there was no option but a major civilian confrontation between supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood and their opponents. So I think the military has it very difficult. I mean, what do they do in this circumstance? And so there's no good way for the media to really cover this. It's a really, really tricky affair. I mean, I feel for any journalist trying to report from Egypt right now, because it's just not easy to present. And so you'll almost certainly end up falling flat, or will basically miss out on one angle or another.
Well, and it's a dangerous time to be a journalist in Egypt.
Absolutely. I mean, right now as we speak, there are battles in the streets between pro-Morsi and anti-Morsi, protesters between the Republican Guard and the pro-Morsi camp. We've already heard of a few deaths, at least in Cairo and elsewhere. So this is, you know, this could very easily spiral out of control and become really problematic. So there has to be some way to resolve this and sort of deal with it. But again, journalists who are covering Egypt today are putting themselves to a large extent in the line of fire, and that in and of itself is extremely admirable. But at the end of the day, it's a very complex picture, and the pieces of the puzzle can only come together if you expose yourself to as many media sources as possible.
Adel Iskander is a media analyst. He's a professor at Georgetown University and is also writes for Jadaliya and Al Jazeera English. And also with us today on the Your Call Media Roundtable are Marcy Wheeler, who writes for her website, emptywheel.net, as well as other outlets, and Fred Weir, who's the Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Just because I know, Adel, we've got to let you go in just a couple of minutes, I just want to find out if Marcy or Fred, if you have questions for Adel or brief comments you'd like to make about what you've seen of the coverage this week of what's happening in Egypt.
I have a question. You see, I think it's pretty obvious that what has happened in Egypt fits the definition of a coup pretty well. Is the American media are we doing a good job of informing the American public of why and how the Obama administration is evading that question? I realize there are practical and philosophical reasons why they refuse to call it a coup, but are we analyzing them well in the media?
To be perfectly honest with you, I think you're absolutely right. There is sort of a missing link in this discussion. Most of the discussion revolves around whether or not Egypt will become eligible for aid. And that, I think, is far less practical. I mean, it's a practical sort of answer, but it doesn't really speak to the importance of the moment and what this whole sort of circumstance means. Because at the end of the day, nothing about those $1.3 billion is really going to transform the Egyptian economy in a substantial way. It's an issue of really, the real question is, it's whether or not Washington can continue to have a role to play in influencing the Egyptian political circumstance, the Egyptian state, the Egyptian military, and various other parties when it comes to matters of American interest, such as the Camp David Accords, security of Israel, whether or not Egypt can be considered an ally in the long term. I think those are the big questions that are, I think, being sidestepped a little bit. And whether or not Washington needs to reevaluate its relationship with Egypt in the grand scheme, so is it as important for the U.S. to anchor its policy in the region on the protection of Israel specifically, and if its traditional allies are as important to it as being able to cater to or speak to or be informed by the pulse of the Egyptian street or the Arab street at large.
I want to ask Marcy Wheeler, anything you'd like to jump in with or a question you'd like to ask?
Yeah, you talk about the economy being really important to this latest uprising and frankly to last year, January 25th. And I keep wondering whether the solutions to Egyptian economy is so far out of the paradigm of what was available to Morsi, what would be available going forward to Egypt. There was the big question about whether or not to take the international loans. Where is the path forward economically for Egypt?
I think you're absolutely right. I mean, it may not. Well, I think Morsi had an opportunity, but he couldn't deliver on it, understandably. And it would have been difficult for any head of state, irrespective of their political party. This is a tough time. So he inherited a pretty weighty circumstance. But Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood have also not helped themselves even in the most basic way. For instance, their popular discourse, which is extremely alienating for Egyptians who are not necessarily in agreement with them as far as doctrinal interpretation and issues of how religion and the state should come together, they've alienated them, let alone the tourism industry, which is one of the most important industries for Egypt. Egypt has lost its industry in the past year. It was hoped that it might recover and be resuscitated, but when you're waging basically a war against radical jihadists in Sinai, and you've got a state that constantly demonizes secularity and accuses it of being sort of a Western value, and really alienates a substantial proportion of the Egyptian population, it's very difficult to justify tourism industry, almost anything else. They've also...
Adel, can you hold on for just one minute? I know we have to let you go. Could you stay for one more, for a minute after our break we have coming up? Because we've got a caller who's got a point I'd like you to respond to. This is the Your Call Media Roundtable. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. That's the voice of Adel Iskander. He writes about media and coverage of Egypt. Also with us, Marcy Wheeler at emptywheel.net and Fred Weir from the Christian Science Monitor. Please stay with us. We'll be back right after this.
All the stories you hear recommended on the Friday Media Roundtable are posted at yourcallradio.org, and they're also included in Your Call's weekly email newsletter. It's free and easy to sign up for. Just click the email newsletter link at yourcallradio.org, and you can highlight the reporting you thought was valuable this week by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is the Your Call Friday Media Roundtable. We do podcast the program. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org, and you can also listen to archive shows there and sign up to find out what's coming up next. On Monday, we're going to be having more conversation about Egypt as we see developments over the weekend. On Tuesday, on our agenda for a new economy series, we're going to be talking about the battle for bank reform today. What is the case that Senator Elizabeth Warren and her allies are making in Washington, and what are the most important changes that need to be made to avoid future financial crises and to make sure that big banks pay for their mistakes. That's on Tuesday. And today, it is our media roundtable. We invite you to join the conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. If you've got a journalist that you read or heard or watched really good work by, we'd be glad to hear from you. You can also email at feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're talking about the situation in Egypt with Adil Iskander, and also with us on the line are Marcy Wheeler, who writes about national security and civil liberties for her site, EmptyWheel.net, as well as for outlets including The Guardian and Salon, and Fred Weir, who's the Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Adil Iskander, we have a caller on the line. I wanted to make sure that he could get a response from you, and that is Antonio in San Leandro. Antonio, if you could be brief, Adil just has a few minutes.
Yeah, well, basically my contention is that the progressives have touted these revolts in Egypt as a revolution. I think there's no such thing. There are two sides. One side is clearly pro-Mubarak and pro-military, like people like El Baradei and Musa, who actually are proven pro-imperialists. On the other side, you have the retrograde Muslim Brotherhood. So two sides where the revolutionaries have no horse in this race.
Great question, Antonio. And Adil, if you could respond and also talk about who is the military putting in the leadership in Egypt, and who are the potential, who are the potential political forces if the Muslim Brotherhood is out? Who looks likely to step in?
Well, I mean, I think your caller is a little bit misguided in the interpretation, largely because one cannot accuse the 22 million people that signed the petition against Morsi of being pro, pro Mubarak, or that El Baradei might be pro Mubarak. It was El Baradei that started the campaign to begin with to gather petitions to oppose Mubarak in a major contested presidency, and most of the people who came out to protest on January 25th. Were supporters of El Baradei. That's not to absolve El Baradei of wrongdoing, but again, we have to keep in mind here that the revolutionaries in Egypt, those who led the January 25th revolution, are a cross-cutting group. Some of them are members of this campaign that opposes Morsi, and some of them are members of the Muslim Brotherhood that supports Morsi's presidency. So it is no longer a clear-cut black and white, this is where the revolutionaries are, and this is where the former regime is. The former regime people are across the board, and so are the Islamists, and so are the revolutionaries. This is a very, very confused circumstance. As far as who's calling the shots or who's probably in charge, yesterday or the day before yesterday, a new interim president swore the oath, and it's the head of the Supreme Constitutional Court, someone who is not known to have any significant partisan political stances. And the hope is that he'll be able to bring all sides together. Unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case. The Muslim Brotherhood is rallying people in the streets and calling for a counter coup, or it sounds like a counter coup, that the military needs to come back to the elected legitimacy. But keep in mind that at the end of the day, 22 million people signed a petition and tens of millions of people protested. By American standards, that's over 17 million people.
It's huge.
By proportion. So this is a very, very large sort of anti-Morsi camp, but it's also a sizable pro-Morsi camp. So how do you reconcile those two? That is a difficult decision. And the military is caught in a significant bind with no real easy solution. Both sides calling for, their sides to confront one another and to, depose one another. And unfortunately, it's a collision course unless someone wise enough would step back and help if this happens, in a more conscious way.
Adil, that's just the situation, and obviously things are going to continue changing right now. major counter-protests happening and violence that we're hearing reports of. I'm sure a lot is going to happen over the weekend. And as I mentioned, on Monday, this is what we're going to be definitely delving into. So I invite folks to listen in. And I do want to thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
Yes. Adel Eskander, he is an analyst of Arab media. He's teaches at Georgetown and also writes for Al Jazeera English and Jadalia.net. We are going to move over to one of the other major stories of the week, and that is the continuing implications of the leaks by NSA, one-time NSA analyst Edward Snowden. With us, a couple of people who are seeing that from different perspectives. One of them is Fred Weir. He's the Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and we think that Edward Snowden is in the international transit zone of the Moscow airport. Also with us is Marcy Wheeler, who, writing for EmptyWheel.net as well as other outlets, is one of the really close observers of the National Security Administration and other surveillance programs. Marcy, I want to start with you. This week a lot of the stories have been about kind of diplomatic implications of what has happened. But can you take us back to what's still unfolding about what we're learning about what the NSA has done and what we're learning about its programs that people really need to keep an eye on right now?
I think the two things for Americans, and it's entirely different for other people from other countries, but for Americans, the two most important revelations in my mind are, one, this Bragnet collection of all American phone calls. The government says it is only accessing that database in limited areas with oversight, although the oversight seems to be oversold. But it allows, with very little changes, it could turn into a tremendous tool of repression very quickly. And so, and even Keith Alexander, the head of the NSA, has said, well, yeah, we could do it in other means. It might take us a little longer. So that's one thing, because the government has all of this data that it, for all we know, it could be sharing within the government, and there's really not a very good reason for it to have taken that approach. The other one that I think really needs more attention is what are called the minimization rules, and these were released last week. This was the subject of back and forth between Senators Udall and Wyden and Keith Alexander from the NSA. Because what they're supposed to show is, here's all the ways that we protect American privacy after we've collected data via some target on the Internet. And what they in fact showed us is there's far more means for the government to keep American information than the law seems to permit. And just as one example, one part of the law says if you've discovered that a communication is entirely between Americans, you have to get rid of it unless. And there are three categories of unless, and one of them is unless there is evidence in these of imminent threat of death or serious bodily harm. That's what the law says. What the rules say, what the NSA has written for itself in secret, is it can keep these entirely U.S. person communications if they show evidence of a threat to death or to property. And that just boggles my mind, because if you think about the degree to which the government has been shutting down websites for alleged IP violations, hunting down music downloaders and what have you, once you've rewritten threats to actual persons to threats to corporate persons and their property, then the means by which they can collect U.S. person communications purportedly under a foreign intelligence guideline, it becomes huge. And there's a number of these in the minimization rules that really haven't gotten enough attention. But that's one that I think all Americans should be aware of.
No, I really appreciate you bringing that forward, because this is the heart of the matter, right? Is like what's the scope of this? Who gets pulled in? And I guess my question would be, just to kind of turn this to the angle of the responsibility of journalists and media organizations. Obviously one of the as different pundits and analysts and journalists have come down on different sides of, whether what Edward Snowden did was justified, whether the cooperation of Glenn Greenwald and other media organization, journalists with him was a good thing, or whether it's a threat to national security that's not acceptable. That question of what we're actually talking about is kind of important for informing that conversation, too.
Right. And it's very technical, and for people to really understand what is going on here, it really helps to have followed the legislative battles going back really to 2006, but certainly to 2009 when senators were raising concerns about these issues, because, you know, we've been getting alerts from not just the senators I mentioned before, but some people in the House. And now we actually see the hard copy of what that's about, and we continue to get denials from James Clapper, from Keith Alexander, and that's where journalists tend to go for the information. What does the NSA say? What does DNI say? But the documents say something entirely different than what the government has been telling us for at least since 2008, and so it's important to understand where the difference is.
So I want to get your response, and also Fred Weir, you in Moscow and a longtime correspondent for a major American newspaper, the Christian Science Monitor, to respond to what the Washington Post editorial board said, which was the first U.S. priority should be to prevent Mr. Snowden from leaking information that harms efforts to fight terrorism and conduct legitimate intelligence operations. The best solution for both Mr. Snowden and the Obama administration would be his surrender to U.S. authorities, followed by a plea negotiation. Now, I mean, I'm just curious what that sounds like to you, Marcy Wheeler.
I laughed. And, I mean, it's the Washington Post editorial board, so that's what you expect.
But is it important when, I mean, because given this is, I mean, this is one of those papers that someone like Snowden goes to.
Right. And Martin Gellman, who wrote the book Angler and knows this stuff inside and out, is publishing his side of the story in the Washington Post. So it's funny because you've got real news being reported there, and then you've got the editorial board making these claims. I mean, the best thing that, you know, in the old style and you know, in the Cold War, what we might have done in a similar situation is make sure this person is put in a place where he can't tell any more secrets. And I joked that, you know, we should have made sure that he got to retire quietly to the south of France, where he wouldn't be giving secrets to China and Russia, which are our biggest threats for cyber war, but would instead be someplace where we've got a little bit of cooperation with the government, but where he would feel independent enough to be safe. That's way different from asking him to come back to the United States, where Bradley Manning was illegally treated for similar kinds of alleged leaking, and engage in a plea negotiation, because, you know, the government is not a good faith actor on leak investigations at all. So it's just absurd.
So that's Marcy Wheeler with EmptyWheel.net, also writes for Salon, Guardian, and other outlets. Also with us is Fred Weir, Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. If you have questions or comments about the coverage specifically of Edward Snowden, the NSA surveillance scandal, and its diplomatic implications, the number to call is 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK. And we can also email feedback at yourcallradio.org. I'm Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on the Your Call Media Roundtable. Fred, maybe you could both talk about kind of the response you're seeing from journalists, pundits, editorial boards, all these folks to what Edward Snowden has done, and then the role someone like Glenn Greenwald has played. And also, Marcy was just talking about, you know, here we think Edward Snowden is in Moscow and was in Hong Kong, where China apparently got a lot of you know, whatever was on his hard drive, they've got it now. Just give us your response from your perspective in Russia.
Okay, as far as we know, and we're pretty sure, he is in the transit zone there at Sheremetyevo Airport. It's a huge area, but thousands of people traipse through it every day, and a lot of my colleagues have had the bright idea of buying a ticket, an international ticket, and going in to scour the zone for him, and nobody has so much as I glimpsed him. So we cannot say with 100% certainty that he is there, but there are Russian diplomats there, and he is talking to them, and he has presumably passed his applications for asylum through them, and they tell us that he's there. So we're pretty sure he must be then, and he's just sequestered somewhere. But the reaction of the Russian government and President Putin in particular is very instructive here, because President Putin himself is an old spy. He was an international operative of the KGB, and he was stationed abroad. So he's a trained spy, and he likes spies. You know, when those 10 Russian moles, you know, came back from the United States after being arrested and exchanged, He treated them like homecoming heroes. He sang songs and bedecked them with medals and so on. And yet he has reacted to Snowden in a very contradictory and standoffish manner. And I think the reason is, and he has expressed it in two or three different ways in public comments about it, is because Snowden is an idealist. And Snowden probably has not cooperated with Russian intelligence. And he rejected Russian asylum when he was told the condition is you've got to stop leaking. And Putin responds to that, that he has to move on. We won't turn you over, but you'd better find yourself a place to go and don't darken our doorstep anymore. And that tells a lot about the Russian government and about President Putin, who this is also a locked-down national security state with a vast program of domestic spying, of which we know not very much. And Putin simply does not want this example, this idealist, to come into Russia to be treated as a hero, unless he recants, unless he promises not to do it, or does something that would send a message that Putin would approve of. He especially, I mean, Putin does not want to be seen by Russian domestic TV audiences embracing this guy. And that's really instructive. However, I think two things I wanted to say about
sure.
the previous question. I saw Glenn Greenwald in an interview just the other day saying that Snowden is pretty much finished leaking. In other words, it's not journalists, Der Spiegel, The Washington Post, The Guardian, and probably WikiLeaks as well, have full copies of everything that's in his hard drive. And it is journalists who will be setting the agenda in future, no matter what happens to Snowden, about what gets made public. And so really the issue now is not about whether he stops leaking or won't leak or anything. It is what will be his personal fate. And I think that the events of the past week have shown pretty strongly that however nonchalant the Obama administration acts about this, they really want to get him back. American machinations, as much as anything else, have probably played a role in keeping him in limbo here in Sheremetyevo. That and Russia's contradictory attitude. I think that the chances are remain pretty strong that he will at some point be captured and sent back to the United States.
Marcy Wheeler, because, briefly, your thoughts about that, what you think in terms of the geopolitics of Snowden's fate?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are too many of the countries he would need to negotiate not only have a stake in the secrecy of intelligence, Putin, the old KGB guy, right, but also in the power of states. And I think what WikiLeaks and now Snowden have done to kind of undermine, take off the mask that diplomats all know. I mean, everyone knew, for example, that France spies a ton, that the U.S. spies on its allies. Everybody knew that, but we, the little people, aren't supposed to know that. And so Snowden took that mask off, and I think there's a lot of states, whether or not they're all that friendly with the United States, that can't have that as an example, as a hero going out there. So I think, unfortunately, there is a really good chance the United States is going to get him back and try him. And I, you know, it'll be interesting to see how easily there will be a tremendous graymail effort. In other words, an effort on Snowden's part, if he is tried, to force the government to come out with more secrets. And that's, you know, one of the reasons I think it's one of the downfalls in trying people for espionage. But we'll see.
That's Marcy Wheeler, who reports on national security and civil liberties at her website, emptywheel.net. Also with us is Fred Weir, Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And calling in on 866-798-8255 is Molly in Carmel. Molly, thanks so much for coming on to your call.
Well, thank you, and thank all the journalists. I really bow to you folks for your hard work and perceptiveness. I wanted to thank your station for rebroadcasting on July 4th the Michael Hastings interview.
Mm-hmm.
And what a brilliant human being and insightful, and what a huge loss. And I didn't know if there's an investigation actually being pursued around his death.
Well, I don't know if either Fred or Marcy kind of have any reaction thinking about, you know, the importance of Michael Hastings' work or knowledge about the investigation. We kind of did a little poking around after you called in and aren't finding a lot of follow-up on that. There was actually a tribute to Michael Hastings published in the Daily Beast yesterday called Thank You for Your Service, Remembering Michael Hastings. We'll post that at yourcallradio.org. Marcy, Fred, either of you familiar with Michael's work or have any comments about it?
I know that... Michael had said that he thought the FBI was investigating him before his death. And the FBI has come out and said, no, we weren't. And so the question is, and I've got friends who are quite close to him, and they're, that were aware of what he was working on. I'm not exactly sure what he was working on. But, I mean, Hastings was the kind of person who would be targeted by, and I hate to say this, but targeted by some of America's elite forces just because he took down the Crystal, and I think that always put him at a bit of a risk. But as you said, that Colonel Davis piece in the Daily Beast really makes it clear the degree to which Hastings was listening to the kind of grunt soldier who was being exposed in Afghanistan. You know, I don't. Everyone in LA says where Hastings crashed is a place where there are a lot of car accidents. So I don't want to get too far into was he being investigated, what happened. But, you know, when somebody investigates the kind of things that Hastings do, you always have to at least wonder whether somebody was retaliating against the work that he's done.
Well, we are going to continue to pay attention to that story. I know the LA Times was doing some investigation. And if anybody wants to hear that conversation with Michael Hastings that we rebroadcast, it's archived at yourcallradio.org. I want to get a couple of folks in here who have been waiting online to talk about the NSA and Edward Snowden. Let's first go to George in San Francisco.
Hey, good morning.
George, if you could be brief or short on time.
Briefly, when you think of the story that's emerging, there's a study of the shape of our data called metadata, and this collection of data and its ultimate indexing and some sort of data retrieval system akin to a search engine is an area of inspection of which we haven't had much to say from day to day. I mean, we can critique it, and we have perhaps a visceral reaction to the idea that somebody's watching our mail and photographing it front and back for reference, and that all of the electronic communications are being handled and shaped in that way. But this is more along the lines of a proposal, you might say, to try to bring together some people who do have a depth of criticism when it comes to the referencing of data and its ultimate usage.
Georgia,
I'd like to ask if maybe you could invite some guests to bring this to the table.
Well, I think that'd be a great conversation to have. I think Marcy Wheeler probably will have some insights on that. But before we get to her, I want to bring on William in Belvedere. William, you had a question.
Yes, thank you very much. I tend to look at things to find out what the individual's motivations are. With respect to the security state, quite frankly, I just see it as a lot of people trying to make their jobs bigger, to pay their mortgages, send their kids to college, the things that everybody does. Their jobs happen to be collecting security data. I think that if one looks at the individual's motivation, that's really what a whole lot of this is about. Not grand ideas about what the world should be like, etc., because the rest of us really don't function in that way. We look for our own personal interest, and I wonder to what degree the guests feel that may really be playing a role in what's playing out now.
Thank you so much for the call. Marcy Wheeler, you want to respond to William's point?
To the first point, one of the things that's really important about this story is we're just learning what the NSA does, the Snowden leaks. The mail cover story, which the New York Times just covered and had been covered a couple weeks ago in one of the Ryson mailing cases, that's FBI. And what it's really important for people to understand that data goes into the NSA, but meanwhile data is also going into the FBI, and then a lot of that data is getting shared with the National Counterterrorism Center, which kind of chunks up the data and does the analysis and pumps out, you know, you're a terrorist, you're a hacker, you're a proliferator. And so even as we're kind of aghast at what we're learning from Snowden's leaks. There are at least two other and probably four other parts of government where similar kinds of data collection are going on, and that data all does probably come together in certain forms. So what the NSA does with our phone data is fairly limited, but we don't know whether the National Counterterrorism Center or the FBI gets that data, for example.
Oh, so we are running down towards our last 60 seconds here. I just wanted to get a thought from both of you about William's point about whether kind of the way that both, you know, individuals and agencies, but also different governments are lining up in terms of supporting, you know, not wanting to get in the way of the United States investigation or pursuit of Edward Snowden, has to do with just these kind of institutional imperatives to grow the security state. Fred Weir?
Yeah, I think, first of all, we have learned a lot about the way the world works in the last week. I mean, if you asked me 2 weeks ago, do you think that Europe would prevent the overflight of the personal plane of a president of a sovereign nation like they did, I would have said that would be hard to believe. But it tells you just how much formal and informal influence is going on out there. But another thing, and I throw this out really quickly, you know, I know a lot about Russian security services, and I'm pretty sure that if a Russian defector or someone was to go abroad with a suitcase or a laptop full of top secrets, that would probably have to be a pretty high-ranking officer. I mean, on someone under military discipline and well-trained person, not an IT guy.
Not a private contractor.
I wonder if one of the stories here isn't that the American intelligence services have just gotten completely out of control and privatized way beyond any functional level.
Fred Weir, it's so great to talk to you. Fred is the Moscow correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Also with us for this hour, Marcy Wheeler, emptywheel.net, and also writes for Salon and The Guardian. I want to thank you both so much. Such a depth of knowledge. We'll have to have you both back as we continue these conversations. I'm Matt Martin, and I've been filling in for Rose Aguilar here today on the Media Roundtable. Rose will be back on Monday. Thanks for listening. Has the ouster of President Mohamed Morsi preserved the potential for democracy in Egypt or ended it? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the upheaval in Egypt. On June 30th, over 14 million Egyptians took to the streets demanding President Morsi step down. On July 3rd, the Egyptian military forced him out. Morsi supporters call it a coup. His opponents call it Revolution 2.0. But what kind of revolution is it? And how can democracy emerge under these conditions? It's Your Call with Rose Aguilar and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And Debbie Kennedy is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.